And that's us live now.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to a very special edition of Radio EduTalk tonight. Delighted, tonight's show is under the banner of Teach Me EduTalk, and John and I are veterans of the Scottish version of Teach Me, and this certainly breaks a few rules. There's no face-to-face, excellent networking, and the occasional beer. We're just going to get together, spend the next 45 minutes finding out about some excellent and interesting practice from the US as well as closer to home. Delighted that over the next 45 minutes or so we're going to be joined by Bob Hill, who many people will know has been involved in education and education technology in Scotland for many years, and is now the among other things a Scholar Area Coordinator for Tayside and Fife, and Bob's going to be talking about Scholar in the classroom. We've also, I think, John, just correct me if I'm wrong, we've got Neil Winton, who is a very well known and well regarded English teacher in Perth, and also Ian Hallahan, who's a teacher of pupils with additional support needs and complex learning needs, and I think Ian's going to be joining us at the tail end of tonight. Is that right, John? Okay, I'm assuming that's okay, John. And first up tonight, absolutely delighted to welcome to the show Anna Cotton. And Anna teaches 9th to 11th grade science in an alternative high school program in Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. So welcome to the show, Anna.
Thank you very much.
And I'm sure we could probably talk all evening. You know, it's just it's very very exotic to have somebody from the across the other side of the world. And I went to a conference in Florida a few years ago and was just blown away by some of the work that's going on in schools in the US. So really interested to hear some of the work that you're doing in schools. Just always ask our guest Anna at the start just to give a kind of brief background to their work in education and maybe their career to date. So if you could start off with that would be great.
Okay, well, I started as a elementary, so K through 6 major in college, and I was actually a geology major. And then I started teaching in New York City and ended up teaching middle school in an inner city school there for 3 years after I graduated. And then I moved to Martha's Vineyard, so I'm almost as close as I can get in the U.S. to you guys out in the ocean on the East Coast. So, and I moved here, and I taught 5th and 6th grade, so 10, 11, 12-year-olds, math and science at a charter school. So that's our kind of alternative. It's a state school, but it's a little different, not in the district. And it was a very progressive school on the island. And then just this year, I moved to this high school, and I teach our regional high school, so it's a school of about 650 kids, and I work in an alternative program within the school. We're for students who need a different style of learning, whether they're unmotivated or having a lot of trouble, not necessarily behaviorally or even academic, but just need a smaller class. We have classes of about 13 kids, and we have a lot of push to do things differently, and the kids kind of follow their own desires and projects, so it's been really exciting.
Fantastic. And it'd be great to hear about some of the approaches that you take. You're saying that it's a kind of progressive curriculum, so what kind of things are you involved in at the moment that you'd like to share with this Scottish audience? And there are people from further afield that do also listen in.
Well, what I did in my old school, which was really progressive, was a lot of kind of constructivist, a lot of project-based learning. And I was wondering if I could bring it to high school. You know, I kind of felt like pressured, like, oh, we're in the big time high school. I need to lecture in front of the class. But, you know, we're not doing that. And it's clear that the kids aren't really engaged. So we're doing a lot of projects, you know, under the kind of edumaker idea. We started gardening. In the fall, our school has a school garden. We have a really active, locally grown group here that helps the schools out. And my students worked on making the garden useful all year and they presented to the community on why a school garden would be important, sustainability, and they learned that's a biology class. Tomorrow, that same class in another ninth grade, we're going out to a part of the island that had a lot of beach erosion, and we're doing vegetation surveys and beach profiling, and that's how we're looking at our population ecology. My junior class, which is an integrated chemistry physics class, is looking at, we've been looking at material science. We use kind of looking at metals and mining and environmental impact. And we're also working with a ceramics teacher to look at chemistry and its application to ceramics, specifically with raku pottery, so oxidation and reduction, a little bit with that, and chemical changes through that. So I just really try to have the kids focused on a bigger goal. And we do, you know, it's, I feel like it can still be rigorous and we can still cover a lot of content while working toward kind of a bigger idea and a bigger project, and having them present their work a lot. So having authentic audiences, for instance, with the garden to the community. So those are kind of the big ideas, and you know, the science doesn't change, and I think it's still possible to cover high school level science doing things that way. Hello?
Yeah. Okay.
No, that's okay. I didn't want to talk too much. I'm a teacher, no. So that's a problem.
And I'm wondering, do you face the problem that many of us would face here, maybe with who look at alternative curriculum, that you still have the pressure of exam scores and such like? You know, how do you square that? How do you go about ensuring that they're ready to sit the exams to move into further and higher education?
Yeah, and that's a huge challenge. I've been on the committee in the state of Massachusetts they have a teacher committee that evaluates the exams. So I've been on that committee for math and science for the past 6 years, and I'm on a physics one now. So I feel like it can be done. I think there's a mix. You know, tomorrow we're going out and doing a vegetation survey, but they're going to take a test on population ecology, and they'll see questions like they're going to see on their exams, and they'll have to transfer that knowledge. Sitting on that, I think some of it has to do with really making sure there's a balance, you know, not going to extremes. So they do a lot of projects, but then they do vocabulary and they do practice and they write essays and they do lab reports. So making sure you incorporate that in, but having the projects, to me, it actually helps them do better because they have something to connect it to. You know? So when we looked at cell membranes today, you know, we could talk about lipids and refer back to phosphorus cycles that we looked at in the garden, and that's a really useful connection when you're talking about something that's very kind of esoteric and the kids can't really wrap their heads around it.
How do you set up the learning environment or the classroom setting, and is it significantly different from other areas of the school that you're in?
No, and that's been a challenge. The old alternative program that they changed was outside the building, and this one's in a classroom. Other than the classroom being smaller, you know, we only have 12 kids. The average class size, I think, is about 20 kids, depending on the class. So we have a smaller class, and that makes getting out easier. I would say one of the biggest challenges is how to incorporate all this stuff, you know, with a high school schedule where they're doing a lot of other stuff. You know, how you schedule a trip out to the field. You know, how do you schedule working with a ceramics teacher? I've done some stuff with we have a integrated vocational program. So we did some stuff with the cooking instructor, culinary guy. You know, how do you schedule that? And that's still hard. And we're in our first year, so we haven't mastered that yet. And I think just because we're in a smaller program and the teachers work really well together, we've got four core teachers. You know, we trade off, okay, I'm taking the kids tomorrow, you can take them all day Friday, you know. So that's really important. And I think it's very difficult to do in a traditional setting where you don't have some of that flexibility.
And what are you looking at developing next then? Is it, you know, it sounds like there's always ongoing challenges and communication between the team and actual teamwork is absolutely vital, but assuming that it's working quite successfully at the moment, where are you looking to take the learning opportunities in the future?
Well, I'd like to do more with our vocational program. So, you know, there's a construction trades and an auto mechanics program within the high school, and it's an integrated program. So I'd like to really have it more integrated. We're doing a project later in the spring with chemistry on creating biofuels and working with the automotive program. And, you know, so we'll see how that works. You know, we, like I said, we did it with the culinary. We've done it with the art. We have a great art program here. So and we're working on it with that. But that's where I'd like to push more, is have the kids really build things. You know, it's nice to make a poster. It's nice to build, you know, we bake bread and done some ceramic stuff, but to really build stuff takes a little bit of time. And, that's where I feel like the big push will be in the future, is having those bigger projects that take a little more, scaffolding to actually complete.
I don't know if John wants to come in a minute, but just my final question, Anna, is obviously with the kind of vocational angle, very often that will involve the local community. So, you know, first of all, what kind of community, or what are the features of the community that you work in, and how do you go about building links with meaningful links with the community to actually take the young people outside? And is it becoming more difficult in the present financial climate?
Well, we're a vacation land in the summer, and we are very lucky that because we're a kind of vacation tourist destination, we have a lot of tax revenue paying for our schools. So we're really lucky, and the economy has been lower, but it's picking up, and we had a good cushion. So we're really lucky on that sense. But we have great support. You know, I said the garden, we have a whole link with an island grown group that works on local gardening and local foods. Getting kids out, like, in the vocational program is big. Tomorrow, the group we're going out with tomorrow is a nonprofit that is a conservation group, the trustees of the reservation. And so I've made links with those people in the past job I was in. And the nonprofits to me here are huge. I don't know what that kind of word would be in Scotland or in the UK, but you know, they tend to have science projects, especially they need stuff done. So I always go at it with the idea of, like, how can we help you do this? You know, can we collect some data for you? Can we have the kids do something for you? And I feel like that is a good way to start. That's how I started a salamander project we did with a nonprofit on the island too. So and the kids notice it, and they love it when they're doing something really useful. So that's how I try to start the community links.
It just sounds a fantastic setup that you've got going, Anna. There's a couple of things I'm interested in, and one is you started off as what we call a primary teacher.
Yeah.
Which is a K to six, do you say? K to six, K to seven. Yeah. And then you transferred to high school. And I'm quite interested in how that went. I feel over here it's sometimes easier in a primary school to do sort of a big project or break out of your routine because you haven't got the pressure of exams. And how did you find going from the primary into the upper school?
Well, it's a process. I mean, I still get anxious, but you know, but I guess to me, I feel like it. Kids don't, they change, but I don't want to lose what they had. So I love taking what kids did when they were younger and when they had a lot of fire. And especially a lot of the kids I'm dealing with right now are kids who have had really bad experiences in school. And they just aren't into school. And so obviously something's happened along the way. So the first piece is engagement. And you know, you can't pass the exam if you're totally disinterested. And that's kind of my justification. And I've been really lucky. I have a really supportive administration that, you know, that is behind what we're doing. And that's huge. But I think, you know, when you can say to someone, listen, no one's going to do well on any of this if they're not engaged. And to me, it's almost easier because they are more mature in high school. I said at the beginning of this year, the biggest difference was I didn't have to tell anyone to stop throwing anything for a little while. So
that's a good year.
Yeah. So, you know, the younger kids are great and they're really enthusiastic. But, you know, again, high school kids are more mature. So, and the content's heavier. So you can get into things in more depth. So that's enjoyable. But yeah, it's a different transition. And the expectations are higher. You know, like in our high school, we have one exam. I think you guys probably do A level. So it's
yeah,
a little
equivalent. Yeah.
Yeah, so we have one science exam, and the kids in the U.S., and I don't, you know, I know a few people have gone to school in the U.K., but because it's comprehensive, so they're doing all those subjects, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know if that makes it easier or harder, you know, instead of kind of picking that focus a little earlier. But we take, our exam is in 10th grade, so it's after their second year of high school. And so they have some time, and you know, again, this is my first year. We'll see how our exam scores are.
Well, that's yeah. That was the next question. Have you any indication how things are going? Or
I think overall, our kids academically are much more engaged. Part of the reason why people have been supportive is our program right now has more kids in it than the previous programs had. So. As far as their academic work, their grades right now are doing better. We don't have any sort of mid-year exam. The exams I give them are obviously based on what I know they're going to see. I mean, I give them exams fairly frequently, and they're doing well. You know, they're and I have great supportive teachers even outside my program in the science department who help me to kind of gauge where they are in terms of the science content. And so in terms of that, I feel like so far it's good. Again, having the practice previously and knowing what to expect on the exams and not, you know, it's hard your first year coming in. And I've been doing it now for 8 years. So I have a little idea of where we're going. And so that helps.
It really sounds a fascinating process, and it's got a lot of parallels, I think, for where Scottish education's moving. We've got a new curriculum rolling out here over the last few and the next few years, which I think will give us more space to do similar types of things, project-based learning and the likes.
Mm-hmm.
So, have you any kind of last thoughts you want to give out before we move on to the next person in tonight's broadcast?
Well, I think the hardest thing, and this is hard for me because I like to have everything lined up, but is that when you're going to do stuff, if you wait till it's perfect, you'll never do it. So I think the biggest thing is to really make sure you gotta take the leap and it gets easier. And that's been huge for me this year because this is all this, you know, I got good at doing it in the younger primary grades and it was working well. And this has all been starting over. And I've really had to keep telling myself, you know, just get started and it'll work and have some faith. So that's the hardest thing.
Brilliant. I'm going to sneak in one wee last question.
Yeah.
Do you notice a workload difference between this and maybe a more traditional model?
I think what you spend your work doing is different. You know, I think I spend a lot of time making the connections between the kind of the content and the project. I spend a lot of time planning the trips and planning the projects. You know, you may maybe have more grading. I guess to me, if I wasn't doing it this way, I think I'd be so bored that I'd feel worse. So I guess, it just doesn't feel like a lot of work. You know, I mean, and it's a lot of work. It's a lot of time. But we have a curriculum document we use in our school district. And I feel like that helps a little and it adds some other stuff on. But, you know, I think in the end, because it's more enjoyable and the kids are engaged, it's saving you work. You know, you don't have to spend as much time on management. The kids' engagement carries them forward in their work.
Brilliant. That just sounds great and really encouraging for people that are interested in taking this sort of thing forward.
Yeah, well, it doesn't happen like that every single day.
Nothing does, I suppose. We know what that means like. So can we just say thank you very much, Anna, and as we say, you're very welcome to sort of stay in the room as it is and listen to the next person, and if you've got any questions or comments, join in. Or if you're if you're going to be busy, feel free to just slip away quietly.
Thank you so much, Anna, for joining us. And yeah, I would echo what John's just said there. I mean, it would be lovely if you could hang on. I certainly know that you'll love the other speakers that we've got on tonight, and who knows where the conversation might go. I should have said at the start, of course, that if you're listening to the live stream, then you can put anything up on Twitter, and you just use include the hashtag EduTalk, and we will pick that up, whether it's a question or a comment for Anna or for any of our other guests. You can of course use traditional email, and the email address is edutalker, that's edutalkr at hotmail.co.uk. so you can indulge in a bit of live interaction with our guests this evening, or you can use those two forms of communication at any time, and we will pass any comments or questions on to the guests after the show's finished. Who do we have next, John? Who shall we go for?
Just going to bring Neil in. Just as I'm doing that, just maybe mention that Anna's on Twitter as AV Cotton. And are you anywhere else online?
No, I think that's it.
That's it. Brilliant. Thank you very much. I'm just going to ring Neil.
Okay. Just while you're ringing out to Neil, we're going to be joined after Neil by Bob Hill, and we'll finish tonight's show with Ian Hallahan.
Neil, are you there?
Hello, I am. Hang on, I'm just going to kill the live stream because I'm confusing myself immensely here.
You'll be hearing yourself twice.
I am. Once is bad enough.
And Neil, there is a rumour that there's a sweepstake going at the moment for the how long into your presentation before you mention the word pedigree.
Oh, blast! Does that mean I have to rework it? Because I was going to get it in the first 10 seconds, actually.
That was me.
I won.
If I'd known, I'd have had money on that. Oh, dear. So, am I good to start?
Yes.
Maybe you could
introduce yourself in case there's somebody that doesn't know who you are, Neil, and then swing in.
I sometimes think my family don't know who I am. I am Neil Winton. I am a teacher in Perth and Kinross. I'm also part of the reference group for the ICT Education in Excellence Group for Scotland. I have been an irregular feature of Teach Meets from the second one way back far too long ago, and have my own blog, and I'm also an admin for Pedigoo, so that's 50p for the Pedigoo sweepstakes. So I've very pleased to have been asked to speak tonight. I'm speaking about sort of my early adventures into the world of solo, which is solo taxonomy. So I don't know if you guys have got some questions for me to set me off, or what would you like?
Well, I think you should just go for it, Neil. It's something that I've seen. I keep saying that I don't regard Twitter as a form of CPD necessarily, but when it comes to the likes of solo, you see it kicking about Twitter so often, and I've clicked on a few articles in kind of quieter moments. So I would just really like to hear a bit more kind of background to it, where it comes from, and then of course how you're actually starting to use the framework with your pupils.
Right. Well, I first became aware of solo. Solo is sort of the abbreviation for the structure of observed learning outcomes. And this was a theory or a means of codifying understanding, which first started kicking around in about 1982. But most people nowadays, we owe it to Pam Hook in New Zealand, who really picked up the ball and ran with it, and she's done some phenomenal work. And you know, if you're finding out about solo, you need to check out Pam Hook in New Zealand. But I came to it slightly circuitously, in that I'd been hearing what David Didow, who is Learning Spy on Twitter, and Lisa Jane Ashes and Tate Coles and a few other people had been doing with it, and sort of saying, you know, that looks really good. That looks as though it's the sort of thing that I would enjoy. And they obviously are talking about the value of it. And so what I started doing was sort of started reading about it and finding out little bits and pieces, but not in any meaningful way. And then somebody suggested that we should try doing Pettigrew resolutions at the start of the year. That's another 50p. And so I decided, you know what, like, I'm going to bite the bullet. I'm going to go for it. So I chose as my Pettigrew resolution that I was going to start implementing Solo in my classes. So in, on the surface, what Pettigrew, what Solo is, it's a taxonomy, for, but it's for learners rather than Bloom's, which is very much for teachers, the infamous pyramid. It doesn't fit nicely into a little pyramid structure in the traditional sense, but it does identify five levels of understanding, which range from pre-structural, which basically means you don't know anything about a topic, unistructural, which means you know one thing about a topic, multistructural, which means you know several things, and then you start moving into the deeper levels where you can make relationships between the things you know about the topic, and then as soon as you can start moving from that to hypothesizing and start thinking about it on a different level, we're moving into what has been classified as extended abstract. Now, at first, you know, like so many of these things, I looked at it and I thought, you know, this is really tricky. But there's an absolutely fantastic little introductory video by David Didow, which he presented at a teach meet. And if you want a sort of 7-minute intro, it's well worth checking out. And it's on the Learning Spy website. So he's got a whole section devoted to Solo. So anyway, I took that and I did a bit more reading, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to go for it. So I went with hexagons, and it's a great topic for hexagons. It's a great taxonomy for hexagons. And so what I did was I literally printed off sheets and sheets of hexagons and chucked them at a class and said, right, write down one thing you know about X, Y, or Z. The topic for my very first class, we were actually looking at a short story by Richard Brodigan. So I said, right, write down something about that you know about the story. So they duly did. And write down something else, and they duly did. And then we got busy with the scissors, and we cut all the hexagons out. And then we started moving into the clever bit, because what the hexagons do is they are just a means of codifying. They're a means of collecting and collating your information. So what the class had done is they'd actually written down things like the notes that I had done and given them about the story. So they've got lots of these little notes and they're on little hexagons. We had a lovely 10 minutes or so cutting them out and people getting scissors into their fingers and all sorts of things. Great fun. It was a higher class. And then what we do then is you get the hexagons and I said to them, without really explaining what the meaning was, I just said, right, take two hexagons, and if you can put them together so that the sides align, the edges align, you need to be able to explain to me why you have put those two hexagons together. And like that, it was like unleashing, I don't know what. It was like, you know, opening the floodgates. Because within a very short space of time, the class were away, they got the concept, they got the idea. And it's what's called relational learning in Solo taxonomy, and it's about the ability to make relationships between different things. And of course, what I realised, and I was very glad I hadn't gotten to stick them down, was that they started saying, oh no, well, you can move that there, and they were moving hexagons around, and every time the two hexagons touched, they were having to explain the relationship. And without a word of a lie, I was absolutely blown away at the level of knowledge, because it was a way of them being able to physically move around their understanding and their knowledge. And it was the fact that they had to justify what they were doing. I had obviously given them not enough credit for their knowledge and their understanding, because they were coming up with some quite phenomenal things. And then the thing I found out later, I stumbled on it by accident in the lesson, is that if you've got three hexagons which are adjoining, you're actually moving beyond relational into extended abstract. Now, that means that you're actually starting to hypothesize, because you've got maybe, for example, you might have an observation about a character. He has attained a corporal's rank. You might have a comment about the language used. There's a quote in the story, he marshaled his energies. You might have another quote about, another topic, another statement about the American dream. And as soon as you can relate the rank of the corporal to the American dream, and as soon as you can start pulling these two or three things together, you're actually moving, you're working at a really deep conceptual understanding of the text. So that was where I started, and I've written about this sort of like in my first Pettigrew posts about my adventure into it. What really got me was that I don't do things by halves, so I genuinely just cut all my classes that week to try using hexagons. It was a very, you know, shotgun approach. Some of it's bound to work. And actually, of the eight or nine classes that I was working with, there was only one that didn't get it, and I'll come back to that if we get time. But the class that I was so proud of is I've got a class which is a challenging class. I absolutely adore them. They're wonderful kids. They need a lot of support. They need a lot of help. They need a lot of time to do things. There are several of them. English is not their first language. And I'm lucky enough to have a very, very good support teacher in the class with them. And we've been looking at a novel by Kathy McPhail called Tribes. And so hit them with the same thing. They were writing down things about the characters and about the scenes, and, you know, I pointed them at some of the language. So they got these down into hexagons. And we said, you know, I said to them the same thing, right, if you can put two hexagons together, that's fine, but you just explain why the hexagons are touching. And hell's teeth, this class got it, as well as my really good third-year class, as well as any other class. And the comment I'm most proud of from that whole exercise with that class was that the support teacher said that she reckoned, you know, watching the way that they responded to it, she reckoned it's possibly for some of them, it's the first time they've actually been learned, asked to think. Not think in the sense of what are you doing, but, you know, they were actually having to do abstract thought, and they were doing it and they were coping with it. And that was when I really believed, you know, this is, I'm onto something. So I'm now investigating it. I'm getting hopefully better at using it. I'm finding new ways. I've just been doing an exercise with my good third year class who are doing a compare contrast and essay of two short stories, which is a really sophisticated task. But we've been using some of the solo hot maps, which are available on the Pam Hook website. And they have been able to identify similarities between the stories, differences between the stories. They are giving reasons for it. And when we tie that in with our very traditional P structure, which is point evidence evaluation, what I'm finding is that we're getting real engagement and real understanding. And really, the thing that I'm proudest of in watching it, and I know that, you know, Tate and David and Lisa and all the other people that have been doing this for years are already way ahead of me on this, and they know this, but it's putting the power to learn in the hands of the learners. The different levels, pre-structural, unistructural, what they each have in common is that they have a series of verbs, so that if you are pre-structural, right, what do I need to become unistructural? And there's a sequence that the kids can look at, right? So if I'm at this level, right, I need to do X, Y, and Z to get to the next level. And that works for each of the levels. So there's a series of really useful verbs which I'm in the process of teaching the class, and that's really sort of really trying to empower them so that I can almost stand back, because they will have the tools to deepen their understanding. So I have found it a phenomenally useful tool. I found it genuinely practice changing. It's got so much potential, and I appreciate I'm scratching the surface and I'm sort of taking the shotgun very, making it up as I go along, in a sense, because I'm kind of finding my way. But the beauty is that, you know, you've got people that have done it before that you can contact on Twitter or you can speak to, and I'm being very open. I mean, I had one class who just didn't get it, and that was my own fault. That was a lesson which I'd sort of like picked up from somebody else and really hadn't. I didn't understand the lesson myself at first. It's one that I would go back to and try again, but it's genuinely one of the most exciting things I have tried in years in my classroom practice.
Neil, it's fascinating as ever to hear you talking about your work with pupils in Perth, and I'm sure Anna or John will come in with questions in a moment. My question is, you spoke about a difficult but lovable class that you've had yeah. some success with. I'm just wondering with the pupils that I work with as well. I think this approach, you know, could have an impact. Part of me though would be asking, you know, these are youngsters who will hopefully move into employment or further training or activity agreements or whatever, but may not move into an academic setting when they leave school. So is this an approach that you think has relevance to pupils who are going to be possibly lifelong learners but not in an academic environment?
Yes, because it's about developing understanding. Excuse me. One of the things that's come through loud and clear from looking at the work on Solo that Pam Hook's been doing is that there are a whole load of concept maps. These are sort of like the bits are for teachers, but they show you how to do everything, even from just finding out basic simple things through to complex things. It doesn't have to be academic. It could be as simple. You could apply the learning and the developing your understanding. You could apply that to something, and this is going to sound patronising, but as you know, to working out how to do a recipe, how to follow a recipe, or how to cook a meal. It's this notion of going through, well, I don't know anything about it. And what it's about giving you the tools and the means of finding out what you need to do to complete a task. You wouldn't necessarily go right the way through from pre-structural, which means you knowing nothing, through to extended abstract, where you're hypothesizing and coming up with a new meal a la Heston Blumenthal. But, it's a structure and it's a support mechanism for learners. And you know, if you take, and I know you know that I do this notion that we're all learners all the time, then it's a case of, you know, it's something that people can do at whatever level suits them. But I am very new to it. I mean, I've only been really trying it for a couple of months, if that, really about 5 or 6 weeks. So ask me again in a year when I've been trying it for a lot longer.
Mm-hmm. Neil, I mean, it sounds great. I mean, partly what sounds great is the amount of enthusiasm that you're obviously got from this into your teaching.
Yeah.
And there's kind of two things I wonder. One is that you said it revealed a lot about what your students knew and their understandings to you.
Yeah.
That they perform almost better than you'd expected. They rose to the occasion. Do you think it also reveals to the students what they know?
Yes. I mean, in a sense, because you could listen to that and say, well, obviously you didn't know your students very well. But it's more the nature of the task, because it's about you stepping back. You're giving them the tools and then stepping them back. Mm. And we can be really quite bad at times of having expectations. And if the kids don't meet our expectations, we see that as not as being, if not a failure, you know, certainly we don't think that's they've achieved what we set out to do. It's the infamous learning intentions and success criteria. What I've found with Solo is that it's very much about it gives them the means to come up with their own learning intentions and to know how to progress. One really obvious one, I thought this was a cliche. I mean, I've seen other people talk about this, but I've got a couple of my kids that have really got the bit between the teeth with this. I've got a first year, I've got a fifth year, I've got, you know, a few others as well. And they very quickly realised that they could apply this to other subjects. So quite off the bat, they are actually now looking at their other subjects and their other topics and thinking, right, well, how can I do this, right? And I don't know this, right, what do I need to do to know this? And it's really encouraging. Added to which, and this is the cliche, and it's not a cliche because I've had this happen, and I'm going to mention Liam, who did this, who said this on more than one occasion. And he no longer says, I don't know. He says, sir, I'm pre-structural. And I just love that. And I'd heard of this, but I'd heard this happening, and it's just like, and every now and again, one of them go, oh, I'm unistructural, yeah. What? And it's really weird because this, you know, it's you don't mince words. You give them the proper terms. You give them the pre-structural, uni, multi, and all. You give them the terms, and it's just really interesting to see, because as long as you've explained to them what these terms mean and how they can do to move from one to the next, then you're empowering them.
Yeah. I have a quick question. This is Anna. Can I jump in?
Hi, Anna.
Hi.
Yeah, of course.
So one thing I've done with my kids a lot in science is concept maps. And, yeah. I don't know, if that's kind of a broad term. And they need a lot of instruction in it. And I've just been, like, while you're talking, kind of looking up all this stuff and writing it down. And it sounds great. How would you compare that to a concept? I mean, and have you used it in science? Because it seems like
Yeah, I'm an English teacher by trade, but the David Didow, the Learning Spy example that he did at the Teach Meet, was based on geography. And from what I've seen, I've got the kids in my class, and I've spoken to a couple of my colleagues in the school at the moment, and we're maybe going to do something with this in, further down the line. But they sort of like can see it straight away. There's one of the maths teachers who sort of like said, oh yeah, we could use this, that, but as to how it would work, I'm not sure. But I know if you do a quick search for people that are using Solo, there are certainly examples from other subjects. The Hot Maps on Pam Hook's website, they've got for all sorts of different ones, and I think Tate Coles has got a brilliant Prezi or SlideShare where he shows different sort of questions and things like this and different ways of investigating based on Solo. And I'm looking at it and saying, oh, I want to play with that, I want to do that, oh, that would be great fun to do. And they're not necessarily English things either, but, you know, so I think it's got great potential. But as I've said, you know, this is my big public health warning, I've been doing it for a very short time. Don't speak to the people that have been doing it for a while, like Tate and David and Lisa and Pam and all the others who are just fantastic at it.
I think it's great, Neil, to hear from somebody that's just digging into something, and I think it's always good to hear from people who are not, you know, haven't done it for years and they're just starting, because you get maybe more of a real deal from that than you will from somebody that's been doing it for a long time who won't actually notice the problems because they're so good at sort of rolling over them. So I think it'd be really worthwhile hearing from you tonight.
Thank you very much.
And I'm just going to pull in our next guest. And Neil, if you're wanting to hang about here and listen to Bob and pop in a question or two, we'd be delighted. So I'm just going to try and pull in Bob Hill. He's, I think, in his mobile, so we'll see how this goes.
Again, just while you're doing that, Jordan, if you want to get in touch, email, Twitter, and the usual.
Hi, Robert. How are you doing?
Hi.
Can you hear us okay?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Good stuff. How are you doing?
I'll just switch off the other one.
Yeah.
Right.
It gets a bit difficult, as Neil was saying, if you're listening to your...
I don't want to do that.
In one ear. And trying to think at the same time.
Yes, exactly. Right. Well, try introduce myself.
Yeah, just take it away, maybe give a wee bit of background if people haven't heard of you. If there's people maybe here that are not from Scotland and maybe not heard of you before, and then just go for your presentation. That'd be great.
Right, okay. Right, well, I'm commonly known as Bob Hill. I taught for many years in Dundee as a computing teacher. But retired a good few years ago now, and now I actually train pupils and staff for Scholar. And for those of you who are not aware of Scholar, Scholar is a VLE, a virtual learning environment, tailored specifically to senior pupils. In Scotland's case, that's higher and advanced higher pupils, across some 30 subjects. And it's an offshoot of Heriot Watt University in Edinburgh. It's the 30 subjects include sciences, modern foreign languages, maths, and various other things like computing, etc. So really the thing that I wanted to say tonight was that I've always been interested in how to use things differently. And the traditional way of using Scholar is that pupils are introduced to it and then they're told to go away and use it as a revision tool for whatever subjects they're studying at higher or advanced higher. And that's great. But in fact, there's a lot of useful material that is on it which could be used in isolation in classrooms by teachers to enhance their own lessons. And so this is one of the things that I've been pushing recently. And I find that a lot of teachers, and I'm afraid this is very much aimed at Scottish teachers, though there are versions of this in England and Australia, but I'm talking very much Scotland. And the thing is that every Scottish school that is signed up to Scholar has a username and password. and any teacher within the school is entitled to use that to get into Scholar and to get into all the material. And a lot of the material isn't just useful at higher, some of it could be useful at other levels within the school. And the tricks I've been teaching people is how you use it, because there are a lot of what are called interactivities. So there are things that you can't readily produce in a classroom, but which are useful for explaining visually or in some sort of animation the points that you want to get across, the concepts you want to get across. It's quite difficult because every subject is probably 600 or 700 pages of web pages. So it's not easy to find part that take your way around it. However, on the left-hand side of the screen, for those of you who know Scholar, when you're in a subject area, there's a link to activities. And this shows you it very much in the way that you would want to use it, because it shows all the interactivities for each of the topics. And you can choose one, and as soon as you've gone to that page, whenever you go back into Scholar, you will find that you have a link on your on the first page of Scholar to that particular topic that you looked at. So there you have a quick way of getting it in classroom. Alternatively, I've been offering people the idea of just copying the URL at the top of the page and either making it, putting it on a Word document or something like that, or using a shortcut on the desktop so that it can get straight to it. And in this way, it makes it a lot easier for people to use it. I'm afraid that's a bit mundane, but I think it's useful for people to understand that they can use it. The other thing that I've just been thinking about recently is that it's a possible way of doing a flipped classroom, because you can, with pupils who have access to Scholar, get them to do the work of reading for homework and finding out about the actual content that they're looking at, and then use classroom time for exploring that context and getting a deeper understanding. So that's a very brief message that I wanted to give Radio Edu Talk tonight. I hope it's helpful.
Bob, it's a resource I think that I've heard mentioned a few times but never dug into. And is it free? That's the question I'm going to...
Yeah, if you're in a local authority school in Scotland, it is free.
Right.
Because the local authorities actually pay in bulk for it. So every school has that username and password, and they can use it as much as they like. They can link other pupils to it, in classrooms. There's no problem with using it. It's not copyrighted material. It can only use it in a specific way.
And I mean, I quite like, and obviously the flipped classroom, there's quite a few people looking at that at the moment, and I guess one of the more daunting aspects of that is the creation of material.
Yes, and you see, if you're doing it at higher, or advanced higher, the material is aimed specifically at those exams in whatever subject you're looking at. So you're not having to search the web for suitable material. It's all there in one great big VLE. And really all you then have to do is highlight the things that you want pupils to look at, you know, in their homework time, so that you can go through it in classroom.
So if pupils using it at home, do they need a login? Or
if it's a higher pupil or an advanced higher pupil and they have those subjects that are in Scholar, then they automatically get a username and password.
Right.
And the school has it. You know, even if it's, the school is not using it, the Scholar administration gives every school that is entitled to be registered a complete list of pupils with their username and passwords.
Right, so all they would need to do is then distribute that
and
provide them with some links.
And it's not one of these ones where you can, where you have to be within the United Kingdom or something like that. You can use it anywhere in the world. And
well, that's,
it,
Bob, it's David Noble here. I've had a look at Scholar, and I know that there's plenty of resources that you can preview even without obtaining a password, and it looks very interesting. You know, you're saying that there's other levels, and I'm particularly interested in the intermediate one maths resources. I'm just wondering that the claim that it's being used by pupils in schools where there's weather closures, but and we've heard that before with GLOW, and I'm sure we're not going to have time to get into a discussion about GLOW and GLOW Plus tonight, but you know, does it sit within GLOW or in what?
No, it's not within GLOW. It's completely separate from GLOW, although GLOW has had links to it, but and the new GLOW will probably have it as one of the tiles, but you can access it without having to go into GLOW. So, you know, it is genuinely something that can be used with weather closures. If you're a higher pupil and actually have your own login, you can actually access discussion forums which are moderated and curated by online tutors who are specialists in the subject. You know, you've probably heard of Ian King, who's at BT Computing. He's one of the online tutors. And he is there at weekends and during holidays and is able to answer questions. And the online tutors contract to do it within 24 hours. So somebody who's, and it's often quicker than that. You know, I can have come across examples where it's maybe a couple of hours before, and they come back with a detailed answer for pupils.
Absolutely fascinating, Bob, and thank you so much for giving us a run through this evening. And just for the final time, we'll say that if you want to come in with any questions or comments for Bob Hill or your previous speakers tonight, Neil Winton and Anna Cotton over in Massachusetts, then please email edutalker@hotmail.co.uk, or if you're on Twitter, just put something up and include the hashtag EduTalk. John, we'll move on to our final Teach Me EduTalk guest for this evening.
Right, bye for now.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
Take care. Cheers.
Feel free to hang around, Bob. And
I'll hang around and listen in. How's that? Or can I hang on to the phone here?
Yeah, that's...
Yeah, absolutely, Bob.
All right, I'll hang on to the phone.
Okay. You can ask. We've got Ian Hallahan. I'm just ringing in now. Well, maybe while we're waiting for Skype to connect to Ian, we can do a quick advert again. You can tweet us on hashtag EduTalk.
Hashtag EduTalk.
Hi, Ian.
Hey there.
You hearing us okay?
Yep, not bad at all.
Great stuff. And hopefully you're ready to tell us a wee bit. Are we still on badges?
Aye, open badges, yeah.
Brilliant. Okay, so maybe you could just start off and give us a wee bit of background about yourself and then launch into the badge talk. That'd be great.
No probs. Well, I'm Ian Hallahan. I'm a primary qualified teacher, and I've been working in special education, and now I'm doing support for learning in a mainstream primary. Badges was, it's sort of something I blundered onto. I'd seen things cropping up. The first place I saw it was actually in my fantasy football team on Yahoo, where you were suddenly getting awards for the blowout of the week and for the best draft and things like this. And then I saw them cropping up in Facebook as well, these wee kind of electronic badges appearing on things. And I thought, oh, that's quite good. And I'd seen Alan Hamilton doing some stuff with Ribbon Hero in his school, and I thought, oh, this could kind of could tie in together. So rather than just being like a leisure type thing, tie it into education. And he seemed to be getting a lot of engagement. Learning to use Word or Excel or whatever, off some what could be pretty trivial stuff normally. The kids were really engaged with it. So with the move towards e-portfolios and stuff, I'd been thinking there might be a way to tie it in. But as with everything else, it all got a wee bit busy, and all the other stuff kind of came cropping in on top, and I hadn't really thought much more about it until I was having a look at Edmodo for something, and they had loads of really good badges, and I thought, oh, this is great, I could use them. And they were really easy to set up and very quick, exactly the sort of thing as a teacher you want, something quick, something easy, and something that's going to engage the children. But they weren't very portable, so you could have them displayed in Edmodo, but for instance you couldn't display them if you had your own blog, or you couldn't put them onto an e-portfolio in a very easy way. Like, I'd got in touch with the Edmodo people and they said, oh, by all means, you can like take a screen grab or whatever of the badge and you can put it up wherever you want, but there's no way of kind of sending it or embedding it or whatever. So I was thinking there's got to be a better way. So I went looking to see if I could find one, and it just turns out that there's just such a thing. And it's called Open Badges. It's getting developed by Mozilla. And the idea behind the open badges is, the, as well as having the picture of the badge, so the actual icon for the badge, there's metadata kind of attached to the badge. So you can see who awarded, by clicking on the badge, you can find out who awarded it, what the criteria were for it to be awarded. You can attach evidence to them. If you want to go down that road, so there's all sorts of really useful information that can be almost in the badge itself. So as well as looking good, it's useful. And the other good thing about it was that these badges could be displayed almost anywhere. So by getting a bit of code or something, you could embed it somewhere. I'm going to go into a wee bit about when I'm talking about the way we're running it, I'm going to go into a wee bit more about the two different ways that we're running it just now. But there is also a way to have almost like a cloud storage of your badges from all sorts of different places, whether it's from school or whether it's from the Scouts or whether it's from anywhere at all, really. So I'd found Open Badges, I was looking into it, and it all looked really good, but they looked quite hard to make. If I'm being honest, at the time they looked quite hard to make, and I thought, this is going to be too much hassle for me to be doing into all this deep dark coding stuff, which really I'm not into. So I thought there must be an easier way, and of course, as with everything, turns out there is an easier way. I'd found this site called For All Badges, and they made making the badges really, really easy. It's kind of an interface between the open badge sort of structure and your everyday kind of stuff. So you go in, create your badge in there really easily, put your details on really easily, and it does all the back of house kind of coding stuff for you, and you're just left with the really easy front of house kind of environment where you're awarding badges and displaying them and that kind of thing. So
Ian, sorry, can you just maybe give us that site again?
It's For All Badges, all one word.
For All Badges, yeah.
For.com. Just .com.
Brilliant, thanks very much.
I put a post up on my blog about all of this, and like all the links are on that if anyone's looking for them. So like I said, the For All Badges just made the interfacing with it very easy. So I wasn't having to do any coding. I wasn't having to build anything. So then we went looking for a way to test it out, and I was talking to one of the other teachers at my school who's also a fellow rugby coach, and he said he was looking for a way. The teaching and learning community he was working with, his thing was he was looking for a way to give more meaningful feedback during PE and rugby, and I said, you know, I might have just the thing, because he was finding that the feedback he was given, there might be some stuff that he was doing there and then with someone who was maybe struggling with something in particular. But for most of the kids, a lot of it was coming through the actual performance of the game. So he wasn't actually giving them as much feedback as he would have liked to. So we created rugby badges, and we kind of thought of the things we were wanting to look at. So we were wanting to look at tackling, we were wanting to look at handling, the ball passing, things like that. And then we graded them. So you've got like a gold, silver and bronze tackle monster badge. You've got a gold, silver and bronze pass master badge. And each of these badges looks at one particular skill in the game, and it develops it through. Now, Stuart, when he did the criteria for the badge, and I did the actual for all badges bit of putting it together. So he built the criteria he wanted, and he also put what your next steps would be. So if you had a bronze tackle monster badge for doing a good tackle during a practice, your next step was to try and do it in a game situation, that kind of thing. So it built up. So we got the whole infrastructure working, and I tested it so that we were able to display what's called the badge journal. And for all badges, we were able to display that inside our virtual learning environment, and it was all working really well. So then we decided to go live, and we were in the middle of a coaching session, a practice session on a Friday afternoon, and it was one of these moments where the kids are running through the drill, but they're not, they know it's a drill, they know, they're kind of going through it, having a bit of a mess about with their pals, that kind of thing. And then it was mentioned about the badges and the performance. Like, I also mentioned we could award them there and then from our phones, and the performance levels across the board in every single group took a big step up. Everyone was really focused on running this drill to the best of their ability, because suddenly it wasn't just about practice anymore. So the impact on the kids has been really good, and they've been coming back and they've been saying, oh, you know, I noticed that I've got a gold this badge and I've got a silver that badge, but I don't have a tackle badge at all. Is that because I'm scared of tackling people and I don't go in? So it's actually helping them to identify their own areas for development in a very child-friendly way. And that's when we were looking at the e-portfolio thing, we were trying to think of something. When you're working with the older children, with the older pupils, and it's kind of your secondary age kids or even at the top of primary school, and they're able to interface with like a blog portfolio or something to a quite sophisticated degree, that's all well and good. But for a lot of the younger children, and maybe the children I'd been working with previously who had some additional support needs, these things were very demanding of them, and they weren't finding them as engaging as they could have been. Whereas stick a badge on it and, you know, give it the kind of gamification aspect, and suddenly they're all really liking it quite a lot. So that's all up and running, and it's all very, very good. But our whole badge structure that we're using currently is built within the For All Badges kind of interface, and we aren't really taking advantage of the more advanced stuff that the Open Badges backpack allows. Now, it's a kind of a cloud area that's hosted by Mozilla, and you can, I think from what I can remember, you can attach a whole lash of different email addresses to your own backpack. And what happens then is wherever these things come in from, wherever the badges come in from, they all get stored centrally on your own area. And you can choose to display them and group them wherever and however you want. So you might want, if you've got your own blog, you might want to get it so that it's feeding whatever badges you've got into a wee panel on your own blog. And the big advantage to that is it's dynamic. So if you get a new badge, you won't need to go and do anything. This new badge will automatically appear. So that's something that's kind of for the next steps. But at the moment, we've got it going, and it's looking really good.
Well, Ian, thanks, Benny. I mean, I've been reading around badges in a sort of casual way for a wee while, and it's really good to get how it works and somebody that's actually taken it through. In the For All Badges system, do the children need an account on For All Badges? Do they need an email address, or how does it tie up with the individual?
Well, I've been a wee bit sneaky about it. When I signed them up originally, the pupils we were putting into it, if you were adding them in through the, they've got a wee interface which is kind of your green add thing, and you click on it and you go to add a participant, you click on it and it gives you a wee form to fill in. So if you were doing it that way, you had to have an email address in. Now, our school, the pupils at the age we're working at, they don't have their own school email addresses, and I didn't want to go down the road of attaching personal email addresses, so I thought, right, there has to be a way around this. So I found you could do a batch entry through a database, like an Excel sheet. So when I did it that way, it didn't ask me for email addresses, so I didn't need them. Tightened that up a bit now, and you need to put in an email address for everyone, or what looks like an email address for everyone. But if you've got 1@something, 2@something, 3@something, it doesn't seem to actually check the addresses.
Right. So you could probably use your email address in Google, yeah, or something, Gmail, so you can have class.
If you've got a school email address for your pupils and they're using it, then to me, it's a no-brainer to attach it to it. Because there are advantages. I mean, if you award a badge, it will send an email to someone to say to them, you've been awarded a badge, go and check it out. But the way we were using it, that wasn't going to work, because like I said, they didn't have their own school email addresses and I didn't want to chase up personal email addresses. So what I did was, once I'd set up all the accounts and they didn't have email addresses on it, I set up a room in our virtual learning environment, and it's called the trophy room. And you go into the trophy room and there's a board and it's got all your names, everyone's names on there. And when you click on your name, you go into your own room and it will show your own badges, and nobody else can get into it because I've tied it down with the permissions from the VLE.
Brilliant, yeah.
Now, each person who goes in, each one of the pupils who's got their own trophy room, when they're in their trophy room, there's a thing underneath each of their badges which says send to backpack. Now, if they click on that, it will say to them, right, you've currently not got a backpack, so do you want to set one up? And if they want to, they can set up their own Mozilla Open Badges backpack through using that interface. But the whole school system is kind of independent of it currently.
Right. So, I mean, and you would see going to Mozilla, where the information is then hosted on the Mozilla Cloud, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know, I need to ask Doug Belshaw. Currently, until you send it to your backpack, I don't think Mozilla knows who's got the badge.
Yeah, I'm
almost certain about that. So it knows who's awarded the badge. It knows what criteria you did. Well, assuming whoever's built the badge has put that in, so it knows where the badge was awarded, who awarded it, what it was awarded for, what the criteria were. It can even have evidence attached to it. But until you do the sending it to your backpack bit, Mozilla doesn't know whose badge it is. It's just got a kind of a... It's been awarded, but it's not been designated or pointed in the right direction or something.
But the pupil has access through their For All Badges account, yeah?
Well, at the moment, the pupils, when they go in, what they're looking at is a page from For All Badges that is displayed within our virtual learning environment.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a fudge around, as always, it's always a fudge. So it's kind of a fudge around. It was the easiest way I could do it so that I wasn't having to hand out passwords and email addresses to people who didn't have them, and still have it tight enough so that not anyone could just wander in and see people's badges if other people didn't want them to.
You know, it sounds really good, because every time I've looked at badges, it looks quite tricky, and you've given us steps. We could actually use this in the classroom now, just be using For All Badges as a sort of stepping stone to maybe the full Open Badges at some point.
Well, that's the thing, and the other good thing is, if you did move, so it's not one of these things where you would build something and then something would change and you would have to go and change it, and then you'd be leaving behind all the stuff you already did. Because of the way, just the way it's panned out, just because I've used for all badges to cook the open badges doesn't mean that they can't be used. And if we did go full whole hog into the open badges later on, nobody would lose anything. It would just be a case of sending them to, you know, just click a button and off it goes.
Yeah.
And you'd be able to carry it forward into whatever way you changed it to in the future.
Brilliant. That sounds great.
Could I just come in a moment?
Certainly, Bob.
Just to thank you, and that was really very interesting, because I've kind of looked at badges and not quite understood them, so it was great to hear that. But it did occur to me halfway through that probably the originator of badges was Baden Powell.
Yep. Absolutely, Bob, yes. the difference, you know, I work in primary schools, and I'm sure you've been in primary schools a lot, John. The difference a sticker or a stamp can make to someone,
yep,
is, I mean, you know, it can make their day, can make their absolute day. And then, you know, they go to get on the bus home and they're like, oh, the sticker's gone, where's it gone? Whereas these, it's like that, except it's a permanent thing, and you can get it home and you can show it to everyone, you know, grannies, grandpas, aunts, uncles, cousins, everyone, and it's never going to get lost. It's always going to be there for you to look at.
I don't think it only refers to primary pupils. I've had that with secondary pupils.
Yeah, I think I've
seen it wouldn't apply, Bob. I was just saying that was it's primary I work in, so
yes, yeah.
Ian, it's David here. I think it sounds fantastic, and John and I spent a bit of time with Doug Belshaw a few months ago. I can't remember, was it in Dundee, John? I can't remember now, but it was in the
DCA. I think Doug's tweeting while we've been on air.
Yes, it has been. And I mean, Doug was holding for it, and it was just absolutely fascinating, and I haven't been able to get into it, sadly. And you know that's, is that a time thing? I don't know. You know, we're talking about the requirement across Scotland for all pupils at certain stages in their 3 to 18 education to have a personal profile. And we're talking about e-portfolios, and I think for many pupils, as yourself and Bob have alluded to, you know, would really benefit from a kind of badges approach to profiling. Just one question, though, Ian. You know, you're a very busy person, and I think you're suggesting that's quite a lot of effort has gone into this, and it just goes back to a couple of big speakers that we've had on the show in recent months who are maybe teaching teachers, but are not in schools necessarily themselves, teaching pupils day to day. However, they're very much of the opinion that, you know, you can't bring in new things like that without something going out the door, so to speak. So, are you able to say what you've kind of had to sacrifice or put in the back burner or drop to actually accommodate this in terms of your work face to face with pupils, but also in terms of your preparation time?
Sleep. No, like,
that's not good, Ian.
I'm actually quite lucky, where I was working like a dog last year on getting through my postgrad certificate in dyslexia and literacy. So I'm not doing anything like that this year. So I've actually got hundreds of spare time compared to what I did have. But the big difference I find is like everything else. I mean, you'll have seen initiatives come and initiatives go, and this getting suggested and that getting suggested and the whole thing. And a lot of the time, it's things that really, if your pupils are even aware of what's going on, they're not really into it in any way at all. You know, it's kind of something that's happening around them rather than has anything to do with them. Whereas when you see something like this, which has, I mean, some of the lads are really, really buzzing about it. When you see it having that kind of an impact, you think, well, you know, that has to stay in. And if we need to lose something else, then we need to lose something else.
always like that. If you're doing something interesting, you can't be doing something else. Something else that's not so interesting, I've got to go.
When I was an ICT staff tutor, I always used to say to people that, in fact, it might be a big overload to get it started, but anything that was worthwhile would actually probably reduce the stress in your classroom.
Well, that's one of the things that I was just about to say, as well as nobody came to me and told me I had to do this. This was something I was looking at, you know, they were saying, oh, you need to be doing, everyone in P7 and stuff needs to have a portfolio and they need to be doing this. And I was thinking, right, how's this going to work? And I've been there when you're sitting with someone going, right, come on, you have to type something, think back when you did this, think back when you did that, think back when you did the next thing. And they're going, oh, we never do anything, I can't remember. And I thought, this gives you a big hook. It gives you something to look at. It gives you dates. It gives you all that sort of stuff. And it's all there. It's all there waiting for you. And when you're looking back to be writing up things in your portfolio, the teacher then doesn't need to be going, oh, do you remember this? Oh, do you remember that? Oh, do you remember the next thing? Here's a photo. Do you not remember? The badges themselves could be acting as the prompt. So that would save you time in the end up.
Yeah.
Okay. I think, is that us? Unless there's anything Ian and Bob have got to say, I think that's about us for this evening. All I think we need to do is say thank you very much to all the folk who've given up their time tonight. I think you've all given just really invaluable information. And it's great to be able to give this out to people. They can listen to it live. They can listen to it while they're washing the dishes later on the podcast. So thank you very much, Bob, Ian, Anna, and Neil. And David, do you next week?
Yeah, next week we've got Ian Guest, also known as Ian in Sheffield, who's going to join us at 8 p.m. GMT. We'll be hearing about all the interesting 365 activities he's been involved in, as well as many other things from the wonderful world of educational technology. So looking forward to that.
Yep.
And thanks to everybody for tonight. It was fantastic.
Okay, so I'm just going to cut the live stream.
Great work, guys. Well done.
Good night, folks.